Let us pray by reading the words of the psalmist, Psalm 98. Oh, sing to the Lord a new song, for he has done marvelous things. His right hand and his holy arm have gotten him victory. The Lord has made known his victory. He has revealed his vindication in the sight of the nations. He has remembered his steadfast love and faithfulness to the house of Israel. All the ends of the earth have seen the victory of our God. Make a joyful noise to the Lord, all the earth. Break forth into joyous song and sing praises. Sing praises to the Lord with the lyre and the sound of the melody, with trumpets and the sound of the horn. Make a joyful noise before the King, the Lord. Let the sea roar and all that fills it, the world and those who dwell in it. Let the floods clap their hands. Let the hills sing for joy together before the Lord, for he comes to judge the earth. He will judge the world with righteousness and the peoples with equity. Praise the Lord. The title this week of our Bible study is God's Order of Shalom and God's People of Shalom. We're, in a sense, continuing what we were doing last week, but in such a way that those of you who have joined us this week will not be left wondering what we're doing. The basis for our study today is Isaiah 7 through 11, though it's going to take us a little while before we get there. We're going to fill in some background. Last week, we traced the development of Israel from the state of being slaves in Egypt to the point of responding to God's gracious act of deliverance by working out an alternative community. And indeed, it was an interesting alternative. We described what Israel had come from. Let's see if we have a working pen here. By describing Egyptian society, which was the typical ancient Near Eastern society, in terms of a triangle, the divine realm, it's really not going to work, the realm of the gods, was, of course, that which was the source of power in the ancient world. And that power was mediated to the world through the figure of the divine king. So let us picture then the realm of the gods. And society was basically a pyramid with the pharaoh at the top. And it was through the pharaoh then, as a divine being, that order, shalom, permeated the various other levels of the pyramid. And at the very base of the pyramid were the slaves. They were really the secret to the society. And of course, it was only by their being obedient slaves that they had a part in the society. It was a static social universe. Indeed, if anyone rebelled against it, what was threatened is nothing other than the whole cosmos itself. Israel, as the Hebrews, the Apiru, a foreign slave group, was located then at the bottom of the pyramid. But the whole alternative vision of what community is occurred when these people recalled promises of another God to their ancestors, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that they were not destined to be slaves forever in a static universe. They remembered the promise that one day this God would lead them to a land of freedom. And it was this recollection that provided an openness to a change. And that involved experience of a God who came to them not through the hierarchy of this world's powers, but rather who met them at their point of need. This God was recognized as Yahweh, the deliverer of the oppressed. And this God was experienced as this God moved them from slavery to freedom. The result was a view of society and reality which was not static, which did not make slaves slaves forever and kings kings forever, but rather one which moved from promise of fullness, of shalom, in the direction of fulfillment. And the entire history of this people of God is a history of movement, of sojourn, of a journey from promise of what God intends towards a fulfillment of that promise. The resulting social universe, or way that they structured life, was as dynamic as was this concept of a deliverer God, a God who met them in the real stuff of everyday life. And we were able to capture the new concept of community, which developed out of this experience of the deliverer of the oppressed, by recognizing as its cornerstone, its apex, a sole acknowledgement of God as sovereign, as ultimate reality. And that, in communal terms, translated into worship. Above all, Israel, if it were to remain a free community, would be a community acknowledging God's sole lordship over life. It would be a community of worship. Also, Israel went on to infer from the example of the deliverer God the chief qualities of that community. And those qualities were righteousness and compassion. And we were able to see that righteousness provided a standard for life, a clear definition of what included one, embraced one within the community of shalom, and compassion, which acted as a counterforce. Inasmuch as a community predicated simply on a severe standard of righteousness can tend to exclude those incapable of upholding those standards, compassion was a quality which, like Yahweh, sought to embrace all, including the vulnerable, the weak, and the oppressed, within the order of shalom. We found, however, that these two qualities, being related in a polarity, could be held together only when unified in worship of God, who was the source of this type of humane and compassionate righteousness. We went on to recognize that although this was a very radical and egalitarian way of community, that early on it was threatened by the introduction of kingship. And there the problem was quite simply this: kings, as penultimate powers, tended to threaten the ultimate sovereignty of God. And so if Yahweh was the only one, Yahweh being the name that Israel used for this God, was the only one that deserved to be at the head of the community, the king tended to encroach upon Yahweh's power and to become supreme in some of Israel's cult life. With that disintegration of this primal quality of Israel's society, righteousness and compassion fell apart. King defined righteousness, and to use the phrase of Samuel in 1 Samuel 8, the people became slaves. In this case, not of a pharaoh or an external power, but of their own king. The egalitarian qualities of the community disintegrated. The king exacted more and more by way of taxation, forced labor from the people, and this is the new situation confronting the prophets. We began discussing prophets last week by looking at the words of Nathan and Elijah, Amos and Hosea. Today we come to Isaiah, the prophet. Isaiah is interesting because he really does illustrate, thank you very much, illustrate the coming of age of the land. If we could call that early period before Kings, the League period, a period of dreaming innocence, a period of drawing out the pure implications of the deliverer God,
The period of kingship could be called the period of civil maturity. This is a people that finds themselves like the other nations. They got their wish. That means fallen, decadent, upheld by the same structures of kingship as the other nations. And that really pressed on them the question, well, what then within such a context does it mean to be a people of God? Isaiah was remarkable, and I think very modern and relevant in that sense. He accepted the fact that kings ruled over Israel, that Zion, Jerusalem, was the capital of the nation. But he held these royal structures at the same time as he refused to let go the basic qualities of early Yahwistic community, the qualities of sole lordship of God, of righteousness, and of compassion. So that's the situation we find ourselves in when we deal with Isaiah, one accepting kingship, but trying to hold it together with the characteristics of early Yahwism. As he does that, he looks at the people against the standard of righteousness and compassion, and he comes up with a devastating conclusion. This is a people who have broken the covenant and who are headed towards doom. We find that, for example, in chapter 5, where he sings a song, a love song, celebrating, in which a lover celebrates his beloved. He has taken very good care of this beloved. The metaphor used is a vineyard. He's done everything he can in order to secure good fruit. And what happens? Sour, putrid grapes are the result. By this time, Isaiah, the prophet, has the whole audience with him. People like a song of unrequited love. I don't know what it is in people, in us, that is really drawn into a theme like that. But as he has the people cheering and saying, that's true, you know, that vineyard should be plowed under and destroyed, then he turns to the people with what we'd like to call a prophetic twist and says, for the vineyard of the Lord of hosts is the house of Israel, and the men of Judah are his pleasant planting. God looked for justice, and behold, bloodshed. God looked for righteousness, and behold, a cry. We find then Isaiah concluding that in spite of all of the cultic apparatus of this country, their wonderful sacrifices and songs and worship services, nevertheless, they are doomed for destruction. As chapter 1, verses 16 and 17 puts it, they have overlooked what Jesus called the weightier qualities of the law. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean, remove the evil of your doings from before your eyes, cease to do evil, learn to do good, seek justice, correct oppression, defend the fatherless, plead for the widow. The very terms used by the earliest Yahwists before kings had come into Israel. Now, that all really is a reiteration of what we found in the Book of the Covenant. Orphan, widow, poor person, debtor, stranger, or alien. The ones to be protected by a just and compassionate society. But Israel was not that any longer. Isaiah was unwilling, though, to just simply deal with this type of surface analysis. Isaiah was a deeply spiritual person and delved deeper to try to analyze the cause of this incorrigibility, this insistence on self-destructive behavior as individuals and as a nation. And what was the answer that Isaiah came up with in analyzing the human heart? We find in chapter 2 in a couple of passages, and I'm going to ask some of you to do some reading here. You are the prophet Isaiah. You have worked and worked at this riddle of a people who won't listen to God's life-giving word. And your conclusion leads you to give expression to your frustration, divine fury, in chapter 2, verses 12 through 19. And since I don't know names, I'm going to try to pick new individuals. I did meet Mr. Forrester yesterday, and I'm going to ask you to read those verses, chapter 2, 12 through 19, and ask yourself, what is the primal sin that Isaiah is uncovering here?
For the Lord of hosts has a day against all that is proud and lofty, against all that is lifted up and high, against all the cedars of Lebanon, lofty and lifted up, against all the oaks of Bashan, against all the high mountains, against all the lofty hills, against every high tower, against every fortified wall, against all the ships of Tarshish, against all the beautiful craft. And the haughtiness of man shall be humbled, and the pride of men shall be brought low, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. And the idols shall utterly pass away, and men shall enter the caves of the rocks, and the holes of the ground, before the terror of the Lord, and from the glory of his majesty, when he rises to terrify the earth.
Thank you, Mark. Now, when we see Isaiah looking at this people, what does he identify as the core of the problem?
Pride,
used, exemplified, I think, in a number of beautiful metaphors. Everything that attempts to exalt self above God is what offends God and creates a self-sufficiency, a hardness, which is no longer open to God. Recall that Isaiah sees this people born of brokenness. It was because they were a slave people, a people without resources, that they were open to transcendence, to God's deliverance. Now that they are in the land and secure with their king, they don't need God anymore. And so pride is the crux of the matter. Now, of course, that was all masculine imagery. It's only men, right, that are guilty of that. Since you're smiling so gleefully, would you read chapter 3, 16 through 26, leaving out a secondary interpolation, verses 18 through 23. So read the poetry in 16 through 26.
The Lord said, because the daughters of Zion are haughty and walk with outstretched necks, glancing wantonly with their eyes, mincing along as they go, tinkling with their feet, the Lord will smite with a scab the heads of the daughters of Zion, and the Lord will lay bare their secret parts. Instead of perfume, there will be rottenness, and instead of a girdle, a rope, and instead of well-set hair, baldness, and instead of a rich robe, a girding of sackcloth. Instead of beauty, shame. Your men shall fall by the sword, and your mighty men in battle. And her gates shall lament and mourn. Ravaged, she shall sit upon the ground.
Does the image, does it become vivid for you?
Sure.
It's really quite exquisite again. Hard, hitting, shocking. There's nothing pretty about this language. But Isaiah is involved in a situation which isn't pretty. Just as an aside, Shakespeare believed in comic relief. In that little interpolation, you have a perfect example of the epigon, the editor who comes along and wants to improve on the original sublime words of the master. So here's someone that feels that Isaiah didn't make the point strongly enough. There are still things in that female's boudoir that could be mentioned. And so the interpolation is, in that day the Lord will take away the finery of the anklets, the headbands, the crescents, the pendants, the bracelets, the scarves, the headdresses, the armlets, the sashes, the perfume boxes, amulets, signet rings, nose rings, festal ropes, mantles, cloaks, handbags, garments of gauze, linen, garments, turbans, and veils. And there you have it complete. And the point, of course, is much clearer as a result of that interpolation. Okay, so here then we have pride established as the problem. Pride comes before the fall. That really summarizes the negative side of Isaiah's message. Now that's by way of background to the passage that we had today. We now come to a concrete situation which will test the theology of this prophet. And the situation is simply this. By this time, in fact, ever since 722, there have been two Israels, a northern kingdom called Israel and a southern kingdom called Judah. We now are at the year 732 BC, And in this situation, we find Syria in an alliance with Israel, the northern kingdom, attacking Judah because Ahaz, king of Judah, has refused to enter the alliance, which is anti-Assyria. They are mustering forces to go against the major power of that time, the empire of the Assyrians. Now, as they attack from the north, they are bringing with them a replacement to the Davidic king. They're going to destroy Ahaz and place a substitute king on the throne who will play into their anti-Assyrian politics. Now, who has read 7 through 11? Anybody, any good students here who diligently have been defying this seduction of this beautiful Holden weather and have been studying Isaiah 7 through 11? You're all much too healthy to be good students of the Bible. So here now we find in chapter 7, Ahaz, encountered by this prophet, Ahaz is set. His political decision is made. There's only one thing to do if you're threatened by a military power. You go and seek out a bigger military power, right? And so you're going to defeat Syria and Israel by making an alliance with Assyria, the biggest world power of that day. And Isaiah, the prophet, comes with his son named A Remnant Shall Return, very ominous sounding name, and he says, don't fear those two kings who are attacking you. In fact, you should trust in God. His message is put very tersely in verse 9b. If you will not believe, surely you shall not be established. A play on one verbal form in Hebrew, the active and the passive. If you don't believe, you won't be established. Same verb. And that begins to get at the core of his theology. You have the pride of humans as Israel's sin. Isaiah now calls the people to what? To faith, to belief, to trust in that one effective power in the universe. Okay. Israel will have none of this. None of this this call to covenant. Ahaz, like Mark's description of kings, is very fitting for this people. Marx suggested Hegel suggested that kings reflect the values of a people. And Ahaz is simply reflecting the values of a people when he rejects this call to trust in Yahweh. That's utopian. That's not effective military policy. The way you win wars is by building bigger arsenals, taxing your people more severely, and dealing with the threat with a type of arm that they will be able to respect. Isaiah now takes this kind of political theology head on. And he says, indeed Israel has a covenant. But what kind of covenant? Described in chapter 28, 15. Would you read it for us? 28, 15 describes, in Isaiah's perception, the covenant that this people has established.
Because you have said, we have made a covenant with death, and with the Sheol we have an agreement. When the overwhelming scourge passes through, it will not come to us, for we have made lies our refuge, and in falsehood we have taken shelter.
Okay, so here we have a situation of a false covenant. And what is that covenant? We can put some specificity into this political analysis of the prophet by looking at two more passages. I wonder if you have a Bible open. I wonder if you would turn to chapter 30 and read verses 1 through 3. And right after that, I wonder if you would read 31, 1 through 3.
Woe to the rebellious children, says the Lord, to carry out a plan that is not mine, and to make a lease out of my spirit, that they may add sin to sin, to set out to go down to Egypt without asking my counsel, to take refuge in the protection of Pharaoh, and to seek shelter in the shadow of Egypt. Therefore shall the protection of Pharaoh turn to shame, and the shelter of the shadow of Egypt to your humiliation.
Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, who trust in chariots because they are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But do not look to the Holy One of Israel or consult the Lord. And yet he is wise and brings disaster. He does not call back his words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers and against the helpers of those who work iniquity. The Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses are flesh and not spirit. When the Lord stretches out his hand, the helper will stumble, and he who is helped will fall, and they will all perish together.
Now, what do we have here? What is the political policy that is being attacked?
Reagan.
There's a man that'll name it. Bob Brown is not known to mince words. Slightly anachronistic. That term was invented only 10 years later, Bob. It was in code already in this policy. Okay. I mean,
in
power of strength, military power, making military alliances, which will assure that your military strength is just a step ahead of that of your enemy. Okay. And Isaiah meets that one head on as well. We find the Lord replying to this and I don't think that Jerry Falwell will quote this or preach on this passage too often, but it's chapter 30, 15 to 17. And I wonder if I can ask you, we should have people give their name when they read. Your name?
Yeah, Gunnar Kempe.
Okay, now Gunnar's going to read chapter 30, 15 to 17, which is Yahweh's reply to this kind of militarism.
For thus said the Lord God, the Holy One of Israel, in returning the rest of you, you shall be saved, and in quietness and in trust shall be your strength. And you would not, but you said, no. Mm-hmm. And you would not, but you said, no, we will speed upon horses, therefore you shall speed away. And we will ride upon swift steeds, therefore your pursuers shall be swift. 1,000 shall flee at the threat of one, at the threat of 5 you shall flee, till you are left like a flagstaff on the top of a mountain, like a signal on a hill.
Okay, and so basically what is a prophet's, what is this prophet's reply to this mad armaments process? Won't do any good. And obviously it won't do any good because it is a false trust. It is simply an idolatry. It is a refusal to take seriously that there is a God in heaven who stands on the side of the righteous one and the compassionate one. And of course we would have to look much more deeply at the situation in order to see how such a military buildup and series of alliances on Ahaz's part was contradicting compassion and righteousness and not just true worship. But it was a situation in Israel, and you'd find this out if you'd read some of the prophetic indictments, where the rich were getting richer, benefiting from the congress with other nations, and the poor were being driven into the dust. It was a social situation, in other words, where the social fabric of the nation was disintegrating in direct proportion to the military buildup. And that may sound very contemporary again, but if you were simply to analyze the message of Isaiah without giving any account to contemporary analogies, that is the dual process which you would find occurring in the land. So that's the covenant of death that this prophet is speaking about. There is a conviction that at the center of the cosmos is a moral nucleus. That is a people of God. It is a people covenanted with God. If they uphold that covenant in a proper caretakership of this universe, there will be shalom. But if that covenant community disintegrates, like any cell with a decayed nucleus, there is absolutely no possibility of viability. That's how certain Isaiah is. Linda?
I said this last week, and it comes up over and over, how much those times are like our times.
I think we begin to get those implications from this text. It's terribly contemporary in a frightening way when you begin to look at this this prophet. Well, the tragedy of Ahaz's rejection of Isaiah's message is that the land, in fact, was drawn into a foe's clutches far more dreadful than was the threat of the Syrians and the Israelites. And this prophet is an exquisite poet, a fantastic artisan in dealing with words and creating powerful images. In just four short verses, this prophet is able to imprint in your imagination an image which describes in an unforgettable way the dilemma that Israel is sucked into by this policy of military certainty. And that we find in chapter 8, 5 through 8. Marie, would you read those verses, chapter 8 of Isaiah, 5 through 8?
The Lord spoke to me again, because this people have refused the waters of Shiloh that flow gently and mountain fear before Rachel and the son of Ramah. Therefore, behold, the Lord is bringing up against them the waters of the river, mighty and many, the king of Assyria, and all his glory, and it will rise over all its channels and go over all its banks. And it will sweep on into Judah. It will overflow and pass on, reaching even to the neck. And its outspread wings will fill the breadth of your land, O Emmanuel.
As background to that, we're talking about water in that passage. In fact, two different kinds of water. And what you have to realize is after this little period of league, where Israel felt that it was enough to rely on God, as one who would guide, would sustain, would bring this people from basically one pasturage to the next, would be sufficient, season by season. As we move from that, Israel reverts back basically to this universe of meaning. And it is the world of kings and royal theology, the sophisticated theology of the time. And basically what that suggested is that the world is one which is secured on two pillars, two mountains. You have a crescent above and a crescent below. Actually, that occurred by the slaying of the sea dragon. And on the outside is all-pervasive chaos. And the danger, constant danger, according to this mythology, is that this firmament below and above would spring a leak, would no longer just allow the proper amount of rain through the portals of heaven and the springs of the earth, but it would allow this stuff to gush in through a collapse. Now, what was so convenient for kings was that they were able to suggest that the only way this cosmos was upheld is by the proper subservience of the people in bringing in their grain, filling the granaries, keeping the apparatus of the cult functioning, allowing the priests to do their thing and the gods in heaven to do theirs. In ancient Near Eastern mythology, humanity, properly named Lulu, was created in order to do the manual labor of the gods. Now, Israel, when they were in the little league, holding on to their faith in Yahweh, defied this whole structure and nevertheless saved a people against the greatest power in the world, Egypt. Israel moved into a wilderness and clung austerely to faith in this God who provided without all of this cultic apparatus. But the convenient thing that Israel's kings then found is that this really gave them a legitimation to have absolute power in the land. Solomon could claim that if the people did not obey the cult and just accept their semi-slave status in the country, that this would collapse. What Israel under kings drew into the cult, in effect, was this chaos myth. And you find in the period of kingship more and more talk about the chaotic waters which would crush in on the people if they did not uphold their respect for the king. Now, second Isaiah, as we said, accepted royal institutions, but very critically. And here you have Isaiah
turning this chaos myth on its head. Isaiah is saying, in effect, all right, you have adopted kings and the ways of kings to secure your land against chaos, the kind of water that destroys. And what did you get? What did you get by choosing to secure yourself against chaos? What's this little passage describe? Chaos, the kind of water which destroys. And now this, specifically, in the form of the kind of thing that your king brings into your nation. What does Ahaz invite into the country, politically speaking? The Assyria. Now, you say the enemy because we know theologically, but Ahaz did it because this would be the deliverer. This would be the power superior to the one threatening you, and an alliance with Assyria would secure you against Syria and Israel, your enemies. But in doing that, you invited in the very chaos you're trying to protect yourself against. Because these waters, the king of Assyria and his mighty armies, will be far more destructive of your life and what you hold dear than the armies of Syria or Israel. So what you rejected is this quiet little trickle of a water, Yahweh's shalom, the waters of Siloam, which is the little streamlet which runs through the Kidron Valley and supplied the life-giving water. You have rejected that and instead invited this chaotic water, Assyria. And it will become a monster which will come up to the neck and finally destroy your life. So we find here then a bleak outlook of Israel by the prophet. This was an incorrigible people, bent on its own destruction. Further preaching seemed to be no avail. Isaiah therefore instructed his disciples right after that passage, 18:16 following, bind up the testimony, seal the teaching among my disciples. I will wait for the Lord who is hiding his face from the house of Jacob, and I will hope in him. Behold, I and the children whom the Lord have given me are signs and portents in Israel from the Lord of hosts, who dwells on Mount Zion. It seems that Isaiah's call vision was fulfilled. There God said, speak to this people, but they won't hear you anyway. Their ears are stopped up, their hearts are too fat, their eyes are blind. Isaiah ends this phase of his ministry apparently satisfied that that's the case. Preach, preach, try to convert the people to no avail. This is a people bent on its own destruction, smug and content with its covenant with death. Now, I hasten through what I wanted to do to introduce Isaiah's message, because I want to ask you a point-blank question this morning. And it is simply this. Do we, on the basis of Isaiah's theology, which is basically the theology of all of the prophets and those that went before, do we here have a basis for a politically relevant theology in our world today? Some people have suggested analogies. In fact, do we take from Isaiah a theology which says no military armaments, no military might, no tax structures, no development of sophisticated weapons will save you if that whole process of armament and development and technological sophistication contradicts the one life-giving principle, namely trust in the one true God? Long question, but I think you get the point. What do you think?
The analogy holds true in aligning ourselves with the forces of destruction and thinking that we can avoid destruction by aligning ourselves with forces of destruction. I think the analogy would hold there.
What happens if you ally yourselves with forces of destruction?
Mm-hmm.
You become like? You know, again, this image of the chaotic waters, you ally yourself with death and you learn the ways of death.
The church has indeed become seduced by the culture.
Can you fill that in, Robert? Or be specific, you know, give a specific example.
We're a reflection of the culture that we live in, not in our heritage that we get from Isaiah.
If we were true to that heritage, what posture do you think the church would take on some specific issue?
From the specific issue of armaments and the armistice, we would have nothing to do.
Would we? Does that mean that we would unilaterally simply disarm, simply dismantle our? Okay, that's a straightforward answer. Who would have a different view on that? Remember, some of you that were here last week, we had another king, Ahab, advocating one political theology, and then we had some Yahwistic prophets challenging that. And we could get probably a similar debate going here. Now, here is Isaiah coming today and saying, if you're consistent to your heritage, if you're in fact going to be authentically a believer in God, you are going to advocate in your country the abolishment of all weapons. That's what I heard you say, Robert. Anyone want to challenge that?
I don't want to challenge it necessarily, but what kinds of activities ensure us following the heritage?
Okay. A good question. Can you help us? You seem not to be settled yet in your mind as to how, even if we believe that this is God's word, which is coming through the prophet, that you have a way of appropriating that, especially when it comes to application to political and social problems, right? Anyone want to, how do we appropriate, faithfully appropriate that message, that heritage?
I really struggle with that because I think that, you know, it's fine that we can see these parallels now, particularly.
Yeah.
But we don't need to look too far back to see some of the things that this country has done unjustly. Internment of the Japanese during the Second World War. You know, things like that. So at this time now, how do we remain true to our heritage?
Okay. Well, she refuses to give us the answer, so I think she's challenging someone else to address the question.
I don't know. I'm here for it.
I told the staff at 7:30 if they had an answer to that, they should tell me before 9. Some people might want to know, yeah.
At least be the devil's advocate here. And I wonder if Solzhenitsyn were sitting in your chair, and if he were doing the exegesis this morning, he might turn us in a different direction, or at least say a plague on both our houses. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you heard his now famous graduation.
I sure did.
I'd be curious to know your thoughts on that.
Yeah. I'm glad you mentioned that because I Holland Village can be way up in the mountains if we don't have a single person that says, but look, in World War II, if the Allied powers didn't meet power with power, would there not have been a double that number of Jews which were exterminated? Okay, other hands are coming.
I would say in World War II, you know, I'm basically probably a hawk. Ideally, I would like to be a pacifist, but I tend to lean up. But in World War II, I really feel that there was quite an act of God in. Because we were basically a pacifistic, isolationist country. There were a handful of people that were, I don't want to call them warmongers, but saw the danger. Roosevelt, Churchill, a few people that really saw this danger before it happened.
England, France, the United States, these countries were pacifistic. They did not want to get into a war. All of a sudden, they went. And the United States got in because of Japan. Why did Japan, that does not make sense to me at all. Why did Japan attack the United States first? My feeling is that that was God's
provocative.
That's off the wall, stupid, whatever, but that's my feeling is that God brought us into that. In other words, there was a point where we had to fight, and it wasn't what I would consider the enemy, the demonic situation that had developed in Germany. That was really once every generation, and that was the once of that generation. Yeah. Now they're thinking, and they're, okay, now there is a very transcendent interpretation of World War II, and it said that the answer that God called us to give was an answer of force and power and suffering. Okay?
Yeah, and that was the same to the realm of the movement of sex war, and which inhibits our ability to get away from force as a means of solving problems, and finding another force to solve the problems that are before.
Where war is absolutely the last resort,
yeah.
And under very strictly defined circumstances. Yeah.
Well, I wonder how much we have attempted to arbitrate or work for peace, not only as individuals, but as nations.
Mm-hmm.
It seems as though the higher up in our government has little effort, as far as I know, to establish better relations with our so-called adversary Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And this is part of the thing I think that we're doing wrong.
Okay. Yeah.
I think events. And I think to deal with the Second World War problem, it's very important for me to go back before that.
Mm-hmm.
When atrocities were being committed, and we, in effect, did know, but we did not find it in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think certainly there are things that you can do before it gets to the point that it did when we entered the Second World War.
Yeah.
So a sin of you know, of omission at that point then resulted perhaps in the greater violence.
Yeah, okay.
I think one of the book that is Albert Speer's Inside the Third Reich, he's writing about how most people chose to ignore the atrocities that were going on.
Yeah.
And he wrote himself that I knew it was there and I chose to say to myself, no, it doesn't exist. And I sometimes think that the arms race, the injustices, I think if you go back to the individual myself, I choose to ignore or choose to justify my country's actions.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling that the Vietnam War probably in the long run is going to be more good for the world because people stood up and said, what in the world is going on here? How come we're not getting the truth from our military? How come our political people are not giving us the security answer? Why are we there? And for the first time, I think at least in this country, for the first time in mass, people got up and asked that question.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask a question just for clarification here. We're describing the unfolding in Scripture of the people of God and the people of the law and people devoted to a different order of reality than the dominant one in the world. Where is that people? As you speak, you're speaking as members of a community and drawing on and a spiritual source of particular heritage. Who are you speaking? Who are you? Are you a nation? Are you the members of the United States? Who are you? What is this group which is addressing the problem of a militarism in the war? Yes.
Well, in the 30s, and it was all over there.
And where was the community at that time which was called to apply to the situation an alternative vision? Where was the people then? What was the people that could have addressed this from a biblical point of view? I'm trying to get a definition of the church. And I'm seeing that immediately when we talk about the church, we slip almost inevitably into, well, here's us. You know, we're speaking in the church, but we are strictly citizens of this country. Then maybe we make some connections with members of another country, but usually those would be European countries. It is very rare that we make connection with, let's say, South American countries, African countries, you know, far be it from our identifying with Oriental people. But if we're going to see the unfolding of this alternative community dedicated to an artist alone, who is that people? It is a people which defiantly claims that any identification of peoplehood, people of Godhood, with a nation is simply idolatry. This is an attack on the primal characteristics of the people of God, namely acknowledgement of only one authority, and that is God's sovereign authority over all people. Now, I think if we do try to just change our thinking the way we fantasize, we will think very differently and draw very different political conclusions if we think in terms of that kind of people of God. Then the issue at stake is not our security over against theirs or our fear of this threat or that. It will be an attending to the most pressing need, which is afflicting this universal people of God wherever it arises. And what that does is not banish problems of security, fear of conscience and the like, but it sets up a series of priorities that dedicates the people of God to a fabric of righteous compassion in the world, which I think will bring to the surface a very different agenda than the one that the church often finds itself supporting in this country. I hope that's not too abstract, but you see what I'm trying to get at here?
If you go back to your analogy, the methodological perception, in many ways, we are functioning under the same mythology as interpreted by our government. All the chaos out there is timeless. And in order to uphold and kill it, right here, our government, we do all we can to fight that red circle out there. But each of the nations is pursuing the mythology in its own way. And if I hear the church saying, or that body saying, the chaos is not out there, the chaos is in there.
Mm-hmm. And saying, you know, on the basis of that vision and the set of priorities that derive from it, we can defiantly attend to hunger and to justice and say, well, you know, military threat of this country or that, never mind. We can take that risk. I think that's faith, that's trust. I don't know what that's going to say about this particular weapon or that, but, you know, I think it is going to focus our thinking very differently on global issues than their focus right now. You know, we're preoccupied. Again, preoccupation with a penultimate good is the first sign of idolatry. Now, you had a point.
Yeah, it also takes off, I think, from the notion of the excuse for chaos in the third world. It seems like chaos, but I think it seems to come from our inability, and this is particularly interesting, to share. And when I say sharing, I don't mean giving, I mean sharing with the third world entities and all people that they can develop in their own way and encouraging them in some way. And we find many modern times, it's not popping up, going up, saving, and all sorts of things. Really, it's a solution of sharing. And the limitations of the need for conflict and requires, I think, in the Western nations, which is to have a very difficult time in this notion of sharing, because we're starting to talk about a whole culture and a way of life that we understand for ourselves, so we play with each other. We would have, and play with, we would have, and we have no emotion right now. And I think this is a position that we don't seem to understand, that we share it more by allowing others to do the same with us in all ways, not only culture, but only in the material ways, and so we would probably be able to overcome the need for war and the need for these kinds of activities to solve our problems, because we would be solving them in the sharing of our people's lives, their individual lives, our individual lives, and all the challenges.
Yeah. I could agree more with that. Yeah, please. I'm not a pastor, but you may have been asking me as a shepherd. Go ahead. Yeah, I am Paul. Well, that's an interesting question, because the earliest kings in Israel did, in fact, speak between Nathan and Gad, both to David. Then we find Elijah speaking to Ahab. But there is Hosea and Amos are a democratization of faith, where they speak to king and people and nations. You can see this in Jeremiah's call, which is there, that at least call the prophecy of the nation. And Amos 1-3 is a series of oracles against the various nations, not just Israel and Judah, but their cities. I think that you could say confidently that these prophets have a glimpse
of God's orders below, as it pertains to all nations, and lay them against the king and the people of Israel to try to bring them to a posture vis-a-vis this world community, which will be responsible and fitting response to the God to deliver the blessings to all nations. So I think that global vision is really a part of emerging prophetism in this period. And do you want to follow that with an opposition?
I was wondering.
I think that you're absolutely right that the model remains, specifically the name throughout the Bible, this grassroots model of empowerment from below, you know, where you just simply do not have confidence in the powers and the principalities of the world. But where change occurs is from the bottom up, a God empowers all of the people to work together without distinction for his orders alone. And I do think that even when it comes to kingship, it is that which exists. The absolute royal ideal from the assertion of self in Israel, the Yahwistic tradition really backs off of that and said if we're going to have a truly alternative community, it's one where each individual works in consort with God to affect this alternative order, this egalitarian self-compassion order. Marie, you had a point to make for a second.
It moves a little bit, I was going to say that in the early 30s, when we were in World War II with our friends, there were a number of speeches in Scythia and different parts of the world, and we did two studies on the continent. Now, one of them I was very familiar with. I was in Johannesburg, not China. But the Catholic Association of International Peace was an organization that had units in many of these countries. And one of the most active ones was in Germany. But as soon as Hitler came into power, that organization was rejected. And it wasn't sufficiently powerful, or even had enough confidence in itself, even fine the other denominations, which we see, in fact, were also in the Germany back then. And then in 1934, in this country, there was an incipient movement of seeing the dangers of race relations, and Father Lafarge wrote a book called No Postponement, meaning if you didn't handle the race question then, in 1934, we would have a big problem on our hands. Again, when the war effort began, all of that activity stopped. And I think today, when you asked the question earlier about the relationship between armament, working on disarmament, and what other alternatives, I think it's a new solution. The grassroots movement at the present time is the grassroots peace movement. Now, if that moves across the country, it has to move also around the world. Because the relationship between church and state had been so institutionalized by 1930, it was almost impossible for churches to take a stand against the state that they were established, because it was the founder of the great
Christianity. And when you find the prophetic responsibility of the church pastors to not be influenced by the state. And of course, it's a complicated world. People often say, well, but the community church, you know, I gather things I hope the church will do. I've never been able to accept that because our world is so complicated, so wide, that it's only when these alliances do not stand for borders that we have some possibility of resisting this immeasurable influence of the state, and then ultimately for the people. And the Christian cannot pay that to any penalty.
Well, that gets back to the question you asked earlier about, you know, where do we find the people of God and so forth. And I want to just share and find out something of a perplexity. I think you're telling me the way beyond that a little bit. When in the 60s, I was on a university campus, and the groups that were aligned around concerns about the wrongness of that war, which a lot of people have voiced this morning, I just, for myself, that was kind of people of God. But it had nothing to do with the church. I mean, the people on the campuses were not the Christian faculty members. They were not so helpless people teaching religious studies. It was mainly secular type. Maybe they had some association with a church in their growing up or something, but they had pretty much said that. And it was a lot of good, hard-nosed, secular Jewish faculty people, too. And maybe their grandfathers were all rabbis, but they had given up any kind of association formally with the community as such. But out of that, there was a tremendous kind of allegiance that was, alliance that was formed in terms of the moral things at stake in this issue of the war in Vietnam. And it, I said it had nothing to do with the church. I mean, churches were very late getting into that.
Yeah.
The Catholic bishops were very late getting into that one. Now they're taking a lead where we are now. There's been a change at that point. But the point I'm making is that I can't anymore define the people of God in terms of any visible structures of our church. It's got to be a lot wider, and a lot that are in the formally defined people of God maybe aren't very, a lot of us aren't too faithful to that vision, but a lot who are not part of the formal structures of what we call the kingdom of God, maybe the ones whom we're needing to look, like Isaiah later on, the king of Assyria is going to do God's rough, kind of frightening notion, you know.
Yeah.
And in the international scene, I couldn't agree more. We need these alliances internationally, but the alliances we will make almost by definition seem to be turning out to be those who are the opponents of everything our government is supporting. So it's very fuzzy, and maybe that's a healthy thing, although it makes it a lot tougher to answer your question.
Yeah, well, it certainly does. I think, though, we can just leave that fuzziness as the proper posture. We're not to see the Lebanon challenging God's sovereignty, so perhaps it's all right to leave a question unanswered, right? After all, we meet again tomorrow. God bless you.